This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. This is the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. We appreciate you joining today with the world-famous, ever-popular Melee format. What that means for everybody... if you are so inclined, if you're not real talkative, you can scroll down to the bottom of the show page. That's where we have the chat room. Paul is over there at has the quarterdeck watch right now. And if you have some topics you would like for us to address today, that's a great place to do it. If you're feeling really extroverted and you'd like to call in, you can always call the studio line, and that is area code 347-308-8397. It's right there on the show page as well, and you can go ahead and throw your questions at us as you wish. But our Melee formats, it's open topic, open phones, though we do come preloaded with our pre-planned responses, I guess, or at least the topic is hands. And with that intro and invitation, Eagle One, happy May to you.
Well, thank you very much. You know, May 1st is well known now as, isn't it the day we celebrate the, all the people killed by communism? Oh, maybe
yeah.
It's another day.
I've noticed that pick up the last couple years, and that beats the heck out of a bunch of uneducated people marching around with big red flags. And it's amazing is not the right word. It's disappointing the fact that not as many people learn the butcher's bill of, mostly the 20th century that came from that interesting political theory that the German Empire helped kickstart there in 2017. I think May Day is a great day to remind everybody from, the Crimea to Cambodia, what bad political philosophy can create around the world.
Yeah, and we don't seem to learn the lessons of the past. I mean, I'm listening to a book, I can't remember the name of it right a minute, but the author who also wrote a book about the Depression called The Forgotten Man, Amy Shale, something like that. Anyway, she has a book discussing Amity Shale, yeah, Shale, something, whatever her last name is. I'll find it in a minute. Anyway, she points out that the same things that were discussed in the 1960s, and of course I was younger then, but still alive, and not that much younger either. But in the 60s, all this great society stuff and all that, well, it's back. We went through it, we realized it didn't work, and now we're back at it again by the same people who I guess, if they're not the same people, certainly they're the people who didn't learn the lessons, weren't around for the lessons, the painful lessons of the failure of these massive programs that the Biden administration is seeming to wanting to inject. Anyway, that's irrelevant to today's topic, which is talking about the Navy and other good stuff. So, Amity Shale, thank you very much, Boston Maggie.
Ah, Maggie, it's always haven't seen you in the chat room for a while. We won't hold it against you. For those who don't know, Maggie. How can I say this without having her get all mad at me? I think she knows this is a term of endearment. Maggie isn't also a paleo blogger in the Navy scheme of things, where she was an early adopter. She was also kind of a blogger groupie. Is the fact that she was very active on keeping in touch with various people who were involved back in the start of things in the mid-00s and introduced a lot of it. I met a lot of people directly and indirectly through Maggie. So when we talk about, you know, me and you and Alex and somebody I'll mention here in a second, good old Chapomatic, you know, they were the paleo bloggers, but Maggie was right there. She was right there hanging with the boys early and often. So Maggie, it's great to see you in the room, but you know, if I didn't love you, I wouldn't tease you. But that's
yeah.
Let's go ahead and kick off. You know, speaking of paleo bloggers, I would I'd be mad at myself if I didn't take an opportunity to neener a little bit. But I can't claim full responsibility. Those that have been around the Navy part of what used to be called the blogosphere, or however the chatterati are now referred to. One of the original players and very influential, and still is, though due to professional responsibilities and the fact that life is busy, has a little bit of a lower profile. He blogged under Chapomatic. You can find him, though I think his account's rather limited on Twitter. But Chap, back in the early zeros and the mid-zeros, he was influential on me when I started to get a clue. And a lot of other people of understanding some of the original sin with everybody's favorite little crappy ship, the LCS. And one thing that he told originally, as he's referred to me, inside the lifelines and then outside the lifelines, is about the whole mission module concept. And along with other hope over experience ideas that framed LCS during the age of transformationalism under Rumsfeld and Vern Clark and all that. He says, based upon his experience, chaps in the submarine community, is this isn't going to work. It's like you will eventually find yourself after much time and money, and I'm paraphrasing Chap, these mission modules are going to be welded to the deck, and these ships are going to have to just do that mission.
I think Sal just dropped off, if you can hear me, and because he's having some weather there where he lives. I think what he's trying to say is that the latest reports are that the Navy is going to add a naval strike missile to the LCSs over the next 18 months, and then they're going to put 15 of the LCSs with ASW modules and 15 with anti-mine capabilities, and that is at least they're going to make something useful out of the 31 ships we currently have, or wherever we're going to have 35. So that's going to be a big change. Now, on the other hand, the GAO just put out an interesting report on the maintenance of requirements of the LCS, and one of the more humorous aspects of this was that let me see if I can find this exact quote. The Navy also encountered problems to begin to operate and maintain LCS, including higher than expected costs for contractor maintenance and numerous mechanical failures on early deployments. In March of 2020, reported the Navy designed and built LCS without conducting analysis to understand and mitigate risks in its unique contractor-based maintenance approach, resulting in costly problems as ships entered operations and maintenance. There we go. I think Sal's back. I hear thumping like Sal's back.
Yep. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you.
Oh, great. Mother Nature is having an interesting day around my hometown. Sorry about that, but hopefully I won't pop out again. But it sounds like you picked up right where I was. When did I die? Because I may not know.
You were in the middle of describing how LCS was. We're going to go to the approach of welding certain things to the modules. So 15 will be ASW and 15 will be mine, and I don't know what they're going to do with the rest of the other ones, but. It's a make do.
Yeah, and I think that's, and we've said it, you know, we kind of becoming a boring scold always beating up on LCS because everybody who are leading sailors on LCS and are running the programs. It's not their fault. They've inherited this system, and they're good people in hard jobs trying to make the best of it. And I think that they have settled on what, and we've talked about this through the years, and we should be happy, that this is probably the best solution. It's not their fault. They've looked at the problem. They've, you know, analyzed the alternatives. And that's the best thing to do, because one of the things that we do know about anti-submarine warfare and mine warfare, it's not a pickup game. It's not an amateur's job. It's slow, it's meticulous, and it requires specialists, both, you know, the individual operators and the crews, because you have to operate the ships in different ways than you would otherwise. I think that's probably the best net gain for us and our allies, is to have 15 of those ships. Now, again, my understanding is the mine warfare and the ASW module, neither one of are quite ready for prime time, though they're close. So assuming we can get those to at least, you know, 80% effectiveness, that'll be a net gain, because something beats nothing. And even for ASW, for a lot of reasons, the LCS is not a great ASW platform. However, the Flower-class corvettes weren't perfect either, but they were there, and they did a good job in the Battle of the Atlantic. So better late than never. I wonder, I didn't see in the article, and I don't know whether you've heard anything, about them taking a fresh look at the Manning COD-OPS, because I think the next shoe to drop would be to go away from blue and gold, especially with some of the maintenance issues they have on these ships, and just go to single crewed ships, because you get a lot more ownership that way. And the service community is not the submarine community, so we should stop trying to pretend that we are. And just let the crew have their ship, and you get that institutional knowledge that way that you don't get otherwise.
Yeah, I think that I put a link up to USNI News report on the GAO report on the maintenance of the LCS, and I think there is some discussion in there about having more crew members who are trained to do some of the work on board the ship. And I think, you know, if you're going to have a module, you just add the personnel module in there, and you can have a lot of folks. And the other thing is that, yeah, and I mentioned it, I don't think you talked about it, is they're going to put the strike missile,
Konigsberg naval strike missile?
Yeah, that's the naval strike missile is going to go on the LCSs, and in addition to the first 10 Constellation frigates, so...
Yeah, even if it's a MIW or ASW focused, the way those are kind of, you know, spot welded on the deck with, you know, enough bailing wire and duct tape to make it work there. And once they're there, because they're in those box launchers, you could probably just have them there because they're there. And I think that's good if you can have them there, simply because while you're doing mine warfare, you never know when you might be called to do another job, and I don't think any naval commander in his right mind would say, "Nah, I don't want four NATO strike missiles inside my area of operations." No, I'll pass. No, I think they'd like to have them. So I think that's a good compromise. Not perfect, not what it was supposed to be, but it's good. I think the what'll be interesting to see for the next year is the Freedom class, the problems that they're having with the reduction gear, whether they're going to be able to get a cost-effective fix for the odd class of LCS, because if they can't, that really hobbles what you can do with them. And I also didn't see, I don't know what you saw, are they having the Freedom class do one of the missions and the Independence class do the other? Are they going to mix and match? Have you seen the details on that, whether they're going to break it out by subclass or not?
I have not seen that, and that you know, didn't they already go East Coast, West Coast specific with the Freedom and the
So,
you know, I think you're going to optimize. If I were in charge of the fleet, which of course they would never let me be, I would optimize it for what I perceive as my needs. You know, I mean, what is it you need in the that these things can give you? If you have to, if are you going to have ASW issues in the Atlantic, and so you're going to want, you know, these LCSs to be the escorts, which they were never really meant to be, or are we more worried about operations around choke points between islands and island chains, and worried about mines in there, and therefore would you have, you know, or maybe you do want to mix because you've got all those issues available everywhere where we operate. So, but I would think more, you know, just off the top of my head, I would think more ASW on the East Coast and surface ASW on the East Coast and more mine stuff on the West Coast.
Yeah, they'll probably hedge their bets, which is probably the smart move, because every time we think we know what history is going to ask us to do, it winds up wanting us to do something else. So a little bit of flexibility there isn't too bad. That's okay.
Lee says in the chat room that LCSs in the Pacific will get the mine warfare and ASW packages first. So,
well, that'll be interesting.
Yeah.
And that's really where the predominance of effort can be. I don't have great visibility on the mine warfare capability of our allies in Westpac, but if things go sideways, I don't think we can do like we did in Korea and just ask the Japanese to do. The Japanese have their own concerns, so it would be smart to have it there. However, in Europe, the European navies have some really good mine warfare ships and a lot of great mine warfare professionals. And plus, the old line, you can't buy training like this. Every time they do one of their mine warfare exercises in the Baltic, they don't have to plant training shapes. They've got World War II mines strewed all over the seabed out there. They just blow up the ones they find.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And Singapore has done some remarkable things with mine warfare stuff. They've got some interesting tools that they're using, these remote controlled weapons that, you know, mine destroyers basically can shoot over the side and they direct themselves to where the thing is and take the mine out. So, you know, it's if I were a country like Singapore or some of the other ones that are bordering the Malacca Strait, or some of those other islands, I'd be thinking a lot about mine warfare.
Yeah, because, you know, you mentioned Singapore. Yeah, there's a nation that, for however that waterway is so crowded, and as the Iranians taught everybody many moons ago, and we saw it in World War I and World War II as well. It doesn't take much to modify your standard issue civilian ship and to be a mine layer, and they could wake up one morning and have the straits right there mined by somebody for some reason. And that is one of the nations that you would really want to have that good mine warfare capability, because if you can't access the waterway out of Singapore, you're in a tough nut.
Yeah, exactly.
While
so we'll see.
About
I mean, I'm pleased. Yeah. I'm pleased to see that they're making an attempt to make the LCS as useful. I noticed also that the CNO has announced that the first hypersonic missiles in the fleet will be put on the Zumwalt class destroyers by 2025. He says.
That's.
So,
I guess you can start modifying for it. 2025, that's, if my math is right, that's 4 years from now.
Yeah.
Have we even tested hypersonic?
Yeah,
you know, what VLS tube are they going to use for them? Who's the test ship? When's IOC, FOC? Because, God, what our Navy cannot afford is to promise Congress and the House and the Senate that we're going to do something on year X and we fail to reach it.
Yeah. Let's see. It's reported by USNI News, Sam LeGroin, our old friend. Let's see what he says. It's they were originally going to put them on the on some of the submarines, right? And then they said, no, we're going to do the three Zim Malt, and we're going to use this multiple up all up round canister, the MAC. And I think they're going to take one of the 155 millimeter gun mounts off. And here's the somebody said. Well, I was also talking about directed energy for some of the ships too. somebody was talking. I thought I had read that the hypersonic weapons had. Here, the Vice Admiral Johnny Wolf, head of the Navy's Strategic Systems Programs, said in November the time the Navy could see limited operating capability of hypersonic weapons by 2025 in the SSGNs. I think we understand the technology. We've proven that in flight. We've proven the things. In things we do, it really is transitioning to production, which we all know in any development program that anybody's dealt with. The science is great. You go out and build one-offs and then transitioning it to that, a very repeatable process, so you get the reliability that you need, and that's exactly where we're at right now. So,
well, good. And hopefully there's...
Admiral Wolf seems up on it.
Well, I hope that works out so we don't play Lucy with the football again. I wonder if they have a backup plan to, if it doesn't quite work out, if they could at least put TLAMs in it. But I know our friend Brian McGrath and a few others have been real excited about that. And I think in an all-hands-on-deck situation that we're going to have with the 2020s, we just can't have a bunch of ships floating around that can't effectively do anything, which is what we have with the Zim Malt. Yes, there are only three, which means at best you can have one deployed. It takes three to make one, that old saw. And something is better than nothing. And if not, it'd be a good test platform. I would really like to see the Zim Malt do a full six-month deployment, though, because I've had a lot of engineers tell me great things about the engineering plant, the power and everything like that. But as you know, until you take a ship and give it to sailors and say, go forth and have a great deployment, we'll see you in half a year, and they come back, you really don't know how that engineering plant works. So it would be nice that we could get the Zim Malt to deploy even in their present, just with their SM6s, just be part of a battle group, go out, let us know how the whole form and everything else works.
They've taken them out and played with them a little bit. They took one of them up to Alaska and ran around up there. I mean, it's not quite the kid glove treatment. So they're really, people have a lot of ideas what we could do with these things. But if you want to turn them into, I think the official word was a blue water strike platform, which sounds really impressive. That maybe we're not going to support the Marines from what the original goal was, sit off the coast and whatever.
Yeah.
Those rounds were too expensive, but apparently these hypersonic missiles will not be too expensive.
Yeah, we should do that math. Okay, how many VLSLs are you going to have? That equals how many hypersonics, which equals how many of those rounds. Yeah, I was thinking when we were getting ready for the show that it's a shame that we couldn't have even done a limited production run just to say that it does work. But again, it's one of those, build a ship and pray for the technology. We don't know because we never bought them. We never put a ship out with the magazines and said, go over to the firing range and put 100 rounds down range and let's see how it goes. We never did that. So we'll never really know, regardless of how much they cost per round, whether it would have worked for better or worse. But again, it's I said, only three ships. I don't, you know, what can go into a follow-on platform from the Zoom Vault? It's the engineering plant. And I guess now would be the NATO, the hypersonic missiles. It makes sense to play around on a surface ship more than it does a submarine class. The SSGM start decomming at the end of the decade anyway, don't they?
Yeah, I'm sure we're going to come up with something new and exciting. But, yeah, no, I think the surface ship is the perfect platform to test this out. And if you've got the huge energy, you know, the energy capacity of the Zoom Waltz, the power that they can produce, you know, the directed energy weapons, the rail gun stuff. I mean, you know, let's play with it all. And I mean, we're always talking about logistics, and one of the things about things like rail guns and directed energy weapons is if you have them, you don't need to have the complete train of ammo ships and all that toting stuff around for you, because you can carry a lot more rounds than you can with a conventional gun system. So, and also,
yeah,
I understand the command suite on the Zoom Vault class is enough that you could really turn that into quite a command ship if you wanted to.
Yeah, and that might be something to look at down the road, being that the command ships we have right now are very old, very slow, very big. You know, the Mount Whitney and it's slipping my mind at the moment. The other one,
Blue Ridge.
Blue Ridge. Thank you. Yeah, the East Coast, West Coast mountain ranges. So yeah, it is what it is. The one of the another things, while we're kind of in a Pacific frame of mind, that I kind of wasn't surprising because they've been a little difficult politically for a while, but it was really kind of sad to see, is our two Anglosphere buddies in the Southern Pacific, Australia and New Zealand, two of the Five Eyes, really has diverged in the last year on China. And there's a nice article in the Straits Times about it, where Australia has, after China kind of overdid their espionage and bribery and get involved in politics, Australia has pushed back pretty hard, canceling some agreements, building up their military. And New Zealand, we noticed last year where there was a statement about human rights abuses in China that was signed by four of the Five Eyes and not New Zealand. New Zealand made a separate statement. And they've continued down that path. And we made a comment about the communists and what we saw decades ago, but they were repeating in some ways. I don't want to assign to a left-wing party in New Zealand communist sympathies, but we have seen free countries in the past, when faced with an aggressive totalitarian nation, have decided to try to see whether they could be eaten last. I don't know whether it's that or if it is something as mercantilist as, I don't want to jeopardize the trade that I have with China, which is significant for New Zealand, not as much as Australia and the U.S., but it's growing. I'm having trouble getting my head around why New Zealand has decided that it is in its larger interest to play soft with China. Is this a philosophical thing, do you think, or is this more along the lines of economics? I really don't know.
Yeah, I think you've hit it. I think it's both. You got to remember that when Australia has joined us in various great adventures like Vietnam take your pick. They've been with us in a lot of wars, and they've great allies, and they've always let our ships into their ports and all that. New Zealand didn't. New Zealand did not play in a lot of those things, and for a long time in the 60s and 70s, would not let our ships into their ports unless we would somehow certify that we did not have weapons of a certain nature on board. And we never do that. We can either confirm or deny that we had weapons like that. So, I know I made a port visit in 1976 to Wellington. And that was very unusual. I think it was 76. Yeah, could have been a long time ago. But that was sort of unique in those days. But, great people, love the country, beautiful country. But, yeah, they're a little different than the Aussies. And, I appreciate the difference, but it is kind of irritating that I feel like there's like one of those European countries is I'm just going to freeload here for a while on defense stuff and pretend like I'm not one really with you guys. That irritates me.
Yeah, that's an irritation as well. I mean, I served with some New Zealanders in Afghanistan. Great guys, really great. But as you know, there can be a disconnect between the military people and the nations they serve. And I think you hit on something there. Geographically, New Zealand feels like maybe they can play a little bit of both sides because they are fairly safe. And they know, regardless of what they do, when push comes to shove, if something happened, that the U.S., Australia, and everybody else will back their play. But they've always seemed to want to posture and almost dare us to do something else. And I thought, the one interesting article, and I'll link it in the chat room here in a second, at the end, and I like this too. I'm going to do a little quote here. Quote, the Five Eyes partners have also been eyeing the possibility of bringing in Japan as the first new member since Australia and New Zealand joined in 1956. Japan's ambassador to Australia, Mr. Shingo Yamagami, told the Sydney Morning Herald last week that he would like to see this idea become reality in the near future. New Zealand's reluctance to expand the Five Eyes has reportedly led to joking descriptions of the grouping in Canberra as the Four Eyes, but Tokyo's enthusiasm may avoid the need for a name change, even if Wellington's commitment wavers. Frankly, I'm okay with that. If New Zealand wants to kowtow to Emperor Z for a few pieces of silver, and Japan wants to buck up, okay, I'm fine with that. And New Zealand can go pack sand or do something. I don't know. But I think a lot of credit needs to go to the Australians because economically they have as a resource exporting country, they have a lot to lose by pushing back against China, but they've been standing strong. So do what we can to help Australia. And if New Zealand wants to, go around the world selling sheep, well, it was fun while it lasted. I'm fine with it.
Yeah, I mean, the countries don't have, what is the old saying? Countries don't have friends, they have interests.
Yep. So, that's a great man. I think
so. Chris says, no, New Zealand just wants Five Eyes to be just an intelligence sharing agreement. It's already drifted from that with interoperability of equipment. So, okay. I mean, I admit that our level of knowledge in this is probably not as good as some of these people who do know what they're talking about. But
there's always been more Five Eyes than just Intel. We could talk about some stuff that we did in Afghanistan that was a hell of a lot more than just Intel exchanging, and it was all built around the Five Eyes framework.
Yeah, and I mean, I think I saw some New Zealanders in Kosovo too. I can't remember, but you know, I think they've played a lot of stuff, but not always on in the have they stepped forward and said, you know, we're part of a larger whole, and you know, with, I guess they probably read what was the book on Australia at the after the atomic war,
say on the waterfront, but it's not that, but
on the beach or something.
The last
anyway,
ones on the beach,
yeah. So maybe they were thinking, well, you know, we're even further away than Australia, so maybe we can ride this out. Anyway, more power to them. Whatever they're going to do.
I understand people who want to, you know, be kind and gentle towards the New Zealanders for all of our history. And I can understand a nation who their anti-nuclear thing. I really didn't hold that against them. I understand that as well. But if you cannot stand on such a baseline thing that people are making statements more about China, with Canada, for goodness sakes, Australia, the UK, and the US, if you can't stand along those ethical lines, I lose patience with you real fast. It's a serious thing. If you want to be part of a culture that has certain agreed upon standards, even though we're very different, then that's great. But if you can't, then you're not part of it. And I think that's a thick line in the sand that the Australians, who they're much closer with, I think have really made a good point at, to a way that even the U.S. and the U.K. probably need to up their game a little bit to match the potential sacrifice the Australians are making economically. So, you know, but again, that's just my opinion.
Well, and it's a good one. You know, but speaking of people coming to the Pacific, how about the Brits? They're starting to re-engage the world in the Pacific after after they left Hong Kong. I'm not sure what they had much of a presence there. So we're going to see a British carrier with.
It'd be, I just put a link in the showroom, Engaging Strategy, which is some folks over on Twitter that always have some good British content. They had a really neat thread going on where they kind of gave a history of what the British have done on a regular basis in the Pacific, going back to outlined what ships they had in 2001, 2004, 2011, a smaller group, and in 1997 as well, which even included some of their carriers. But this is a great coming out party for the there are some great diagrams that show the old ski jump carriers of the Invincibles class that the British had compared to the new Queen Elizabeth II and not Queen Elizabeth II, QE, the Queen Elizabeth and the Prince of Wales, much larger carriers, not, you know, Nimitz or Ford size, but, you know, something along the lines of the Charles, I think it might be bigger than the Charles de Gaulle. I could be wrong. And the air wing's going to have U.S. Marine Corps F-35s on it, along with the British. And it's going to have a multinational. I think there's a Dutch frigate that's going with them, an American DDG. And I'm sure they'll pick up some players along the way for a day or a week or so as they go through the Indian Ocean and the Pacific. It'll be neat to see what they do, especially around the South China Sea. And they do have historical and allied commitments there. And I think many happy returns. I don't know how much they can do it, though, because their fleet's so small. But I'd encourage folks, if you have access to Twitter, and if you're with us live, in the showroom, you can follow that link. It's a nice historical outline of what the Royal Navy has done in the Pacific recently.
Yeah, that's it's good to see him. It's good to see him back. It's good, and you know, we've talked about this before. An island nation appreciates the role of Sea Power more than anybody else. I hope that the Sea Lord who came up with the phrase "Sea Blindness" feels like he's been vindicated by the way they've suddenly come to play with some pretty nice equipment. And even though they're very small still, they're out there pushing what they've got. So that's great.
And I think it'll also help out the nation we were just talking about, Australia. Those are familiar with what Australia did as part of the Commonwealth and the British Empire in World War I and World War II. You know, they took their youth and they went to Africa and the Malay Peninsula and fought for Britain. And even though it wasn't their fight geographically, so to speak, very much, except in World War II. So it's good for the British to go out there to keep that connection going as part of the Commonwealth. And, yeah, the more the merrier. I think I read somewhere the French were going to be doing some type of Pacific deployment, but it may have just been a ship or two. I don't think the Charles de Gaulle is coming out. But it would be too bad if the Charles de Gaulle could find a way to wander through the Pacific again sometime in the next half decade or so. Like you said, they're not the huge navies they once were, but as a group, they're a potent force.
Yeah, and we mentioned New Zealand too. I mean, I don't know if this will maybe tweak the New Zealanders a little bit. I mean, the ANZAC forces played a huge role in the wars. I mean, maybe not necessarily under the best generalship like Gallipoli and stuff, but they were a team with Australia, New Zealand for a long time, and defense of the empire. Now I know they're an independent country now and all that, although part of the Commonwealth. So we'll see how this works out. It'll be interesting. And as far as the French go, you know, they've really come forward with a lot of stuff over the years. Where they, like when we were short a carrier in the Middle East, they put their own carrier out there for us. You know, and I know that when my one of my sons was going through flight school, they had French pilots working with them, going through the schools too. So, getting their Navy, U.S. Navy wings at the Meridian. So, we're working more closely with the French than I think we have in years, and it's good to see them working with us and joining with the with the rest of the world. For a long time we had some difficulty with their willingness to be more aloof than we would have preferred, but I think that's kind of shifted too.
It has. I think that's one of the underappreciated things of the last decade to 15 years is, and France has always had on a military-to-military basis, a very good relationship with the U.S. Navy specifically, but everybody who's had a chance to work with them in general has had a great relationship with them. They rejoined NATO a decade ago, the military structure, and they are more integrated that way, so more Americans are serving with the French. We've been working with them a lot in North Africa. They did help us a little bit in Afghanistan and a little bit in Iraq. Not much, but pound for pound, they are very good, and they are participating more and more. And I think you're spot on. That's one of the little trends. It hasn't been a big spike, but if I was looking at that curve, that the French curve of working with the U.S. more than us just helping with their carriers, helping more in some of the hot spots around the world, and a general willingness to be part of the solution, I think is one of the really national security good news issues here. Plus, they do spend, plus or minus a few tenths of a percent, about 2% of their GDP on defense. It'd be great if they had two or three carriers as opposed to one. But the Charles, they have at least on paper plans for a replacement for the Charles de Gaulle, which will probably go nuclear again, which is going to make it more expensive. And I think what is now the Queen Elizabeth class, when it got started, originally France was going to build off of that design, but early on in the process, France decided they couldn't work with the English or something. So that fell apart, but they'll come up with their own domestic design. And I know that people like to throw a little shade on the old aircraft carrier, whether it's useful or not. It is useful. If it wasn't useful, everybody who could afford one wouldn't be building one, especially at size. Whether it's peacetime operations or, you know, in wartime, if you want to own some part of the ocean, you've got to own the air, and you can't do that from a surface ship alone. So they will, unless the hypersonic global prompt strike Uber advocates are perfectly correct, that at the press of a button, any ship anywhere in the world can disappear in a hypersonic shockwave in the course of 15 minutes. Aircraft carriers will continue to be an important part of any nation that wishes to have a substantial global presence, whether it's a big deck, like the Brits, we, and the French, if you want to define the Charles de Gaulle as a big deck, which I think is fair to do, or even the small decks like the Chinese, not the Chinese, that's a medium deck, but I'll just stick with our friends, the Italians, the Spaniards, and even the Australian amphibious carrier that they built off the Spanish design. It has some utility, though they're not flying any fixed wing off of them.
Yeah, and our pilots land on their carrier, and our pilots land on our carriers. It kind of works out pretty well. But speaking of interesting discussions of the Navy, Blake Herzinger has stirred up quite a hornet's nest with his piece in foreign policy about give the U.S. Navy the Army's money.
I was really proud of young Blake. Nice young man. You know, our favorite expat and Midrats alumni. For those listening right now, I'll just go back, what was it, 4 or 5 episodes we had Blake on board. But when I read that, I smiled a lot because he and a few other people managed to break above the background noise and the howling and, you know, flinty, insecure reactions. It hit the note at the right time. And, you know, you and I have talked about it for years. Other people have as well, but it wasn't breaking into the background noise. But I think what people are looking at are the challenge of the 2020s. And enough people are making the argument that it's right at the ambient noise level, and Blake managed to pop above there. And I would encourage everybody who has it now. Unfortunately, it's behind the foreign policy firewall that you have to pay for. If you've looked at foreign policy, very foreign policy, Blake's work up there, but in the chat room, I'll put a link to the article. I'd encourage everybody to read it, but the best thing about it was the title. Not only was it clickbait, but it really, when you break it down, it's if you want a big Navy, the only way you're going to get it is you got to take it from the Army. And, sometimes you got to rip off the Band-Aid. Good argument, and it brought a bunch of good secondary discussions with it that is healthy.
Yeah, he got quite a few comments from Army people who are unhappy with the concept of, well, no, our Army's really important. And everybody else is going, well, how are you going to get wherever it is we're going to go? Anyway. You know, and other people have riffed off what Blake wrote to mention things like, well, if you're going to have improve the Navy and shipyards, then we also need to get some, you know, larger merchant force fleet again and all that good stuff. I mean, you know, it's a good conversation starter, shall we say.
Well, there are uncomfortable truths out there that people don't like to talk about. The reason I don't like to talk about it is because, well, you're going to upset person X and upset person Y. Unfortunately, Midrats isn't sponsored by anybody, so we can talk about whatever the hell we want to. But there are other people who are limited on what they can say because they've got bills to pay. And there's also that culture of the joint, which makes people not want to upset people or be too parochial. I like the creative friction part of it. If the Army guys, besides yelling shut up and sticking their fingers in the air and holding their breath till their face turns purple, if they want to engage in an argument, a discussion, some creative friction about what is the best overall use of money, then let's do it. Let's you know, we'll have to call each other names or make fun of each other's uniforms. Well, maybe not too much, but I think let's do it. Let's bring the Air Force in. Let's argue about it and let the best ideas win. And there is a downside here for, you know, one of my favorite benchmarks is during the 1970s, the Royal Navy lost its argument with the Royal Air Force. They managed to convince all the decision makers that land-based tornadoes could create all the, quote, effects, unquote, that a carrier group could do, so you don't need a big deck carrier. So I don't know whether it was 1 or 2 years before the Argentinians took the Falklands. They had decommissioned their last big deck carrier with all those beautiful Phantoms and Buccaneers on board. So, yeah, when you engage in these arguments, you need to bring your A game and your A team, because if you lose the argument and the less effective argument wins, your nation can find itself at some risk. But I think the argument's worth it, and the Navy position, as we've talked about here, is very defendable, very easy to argue. The Army position, a little more challenging.
Yeah, I think you kind of touched on this in the piece you wrote for USNI blog about our number one national security threat. You know, complacency, we've always done it this way. You know, those are deadly things for our defense structure. We don't have the luxury of spending. We've already spent money foolishly. Well, we need to be smart, right? So what provides the biggest national security benefit for the buck? And having a strong Navy, to me, of course, I'm a Navy guy, although I did grow up an Air Force brat and my wife was an Army brat. Anyway, you know, the Navy's the answer. You know, we need to have a strong Navy. And this, I just don't understand why people can't understand why that's so logical the way it is to me.
And the interesting thing is I'm always harping on, you know, up on the hill, who's the leadership? And without being as nonpartisan as possible here, it historically has been looked at that the Republican Party was the party of national defense, blah, 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 blah. However, in the last year, the two most effective voices when it comes to talking about the Navy, one, I'll start with the old war horse, Senator from Rhode Island, Senator Reid, everybody knows what a great supporter of the Navy he's been for a long time. But over in the House, representative from, I believe, the 2nd Congressional District in Virginia, Representative Luria, part of the esoteric honorable house of retired Navy O5s. She has been really good. Mike Gallagher has been very good on the Republican side of the house. And there's just been such a big gap in the Senate since Senator McCain left. I don't know what it's going to take for somebody to be able to step in those shoes, but you know, we really need a good bipartisan naval advocates to really be able to push this argument, be willing to fight this too, because this battle just can't be fought on Twitter and on foreign policy at U.S. Naval Institute. It's going to have to be fought up on the Hill with the right staffers in the right place and the right leaders with good arguments in both political parties. And so I'm looking for more people to join Gloria and Gallagher and Senator Reid. And I don't know if you have some other names that you've seen up on the House that are going to make this a priority and are going to take a few chances, because those senator from Rhode Island, he's not taking any chances because he's an old bull. He's bulletproof. But Gloria and Gallagher are relatively junior for their political parties, and they've invested a lot of time and effort in these issues. I just wish they had more people run with them.
Yeah, I mean, it's the eternal, you know, I look at the way we're spending money, like, shall I, dare I say it, like drunken sailors on everything from, we're insane. I keep getting checks from the government. I'm not quite sure why, just because I'm breathing, you know. I don't know. Not the normal checks I get because I'm breathing, but the ones that are part of this COVID-19 thing. I mean, how many billions of dollars have we just thrown? And then I keep reading about the amount of fraud, and I go, there's your carrier. There's your extra,
yep,
you know, your payments for the shipyard improvements you need. There's, you know, what in the world? If we just stop the fraud, waste, and abuse, we could probably do enough to rebuild the Navy the way we'd like to see it. And that bothers me a lot.
I think that's going to be a sore subject for the rest of the decade. These stories are going to start coming out about the fraud involved with this and the amount of money that our grandchildren are going to have to pay for. Because it's all borrowed. It's all borrowed money. But, you know, floating dry docks aren't that expensive. You know, forget about there's another carrier. There's four floating dry docks for a rounding error for the money they're spending out, they're sitting out there. And what was it? I know there's other things besides floating dry docks, but the USS Boise was out of action for the better part of half a decade because it just couldn't get the yard time it needed that could handle submarines. Everybody talks about how important it is to grow the submarine force. Good gracious, people. In peacetime, we had a submarine sit around for 5 years because it kept getting short-ended on the maintenance cycle. But, yeah, you know, literally shipyards is infrastructure. And they're good-paying jobs, too. And I know Byron and Lee have been good about pointing this out, that you can't just, you know, there were a lot of underemployed welders and people used to manufacturing during the Great Depression, so you could ramp up pretty good because the guy said, you know, well, I was a welder 5 years ago. I can pick up a welding torch again. You can't create these workers overnight, but you've got to start to do it so you can get them trained up. But if you pay them well enough, people will come out of the shadows to do the job. You just got to pay them the right amount.
Yeah. And, you know, we just need to get, you know, it's the, as I was saying, that book, The Great Society, the Hamity Shales book. You know, she's talking about this. Why are we're going back through this same cycle again? You know, we're going to throw money at the problems of poverty. We're going to throw money at the problems of this and that. You know, it didn't work last time. It probably won't work this time. We need to really take all these things back to the bare metal and start from scratch. And, you know, but the fundamental thing, the thing that's in our Constitution is to build and maintain a Navy. I mean, that's fundamental. Speaking of which, I think you pointed out to me in our kind of pre-show thing, this is the 60th anniversary of a torpedo attacking a dam. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, and I realized I had thought that I had done a full bore Friday. For those that don't read my blog, every Friday I put out, I call it Full Bore Friday. That's usually, it started off with just me getting pictures of battleships because, you know, my sexual orientation is battleship. I love battleships. But it turned into, there are just tons of stories in the military tradition that are underknown or at least not known to me. And so I find them and I go, hey, this is a great story. Put it out there. I thought I had done a full Wolf Friday and I never had. But this, I will next week. I had tweeted it. My mind said, well, you've blogged about it. No, I put a tweet about years ago on it. But this is the anniversary in 1951. And here's the great part of the story. And there's been some real journalists that have done some great detailed story of it. Is a bunch of guys and a Sky Raider squadron during the Korean War. They were, and this is also a story that we should tell to the Chinese on a regular basis. You've heard my dam buster theory, if we need to again. Anyway, that there was this big challenge that they wanted to take out one of the North Korean dams. And, you know, everybody knew the dam buster story 6 years after World War II. But how are they going to do it? And, you know, dams are something that are solid concrete, as this was. You can drop 500-pound bombs and miss all day. And then they realized, wait a minute, we have torpedoes. They were 80s were designed to carry torpedoes, but they hadn't done the training. They were just doing ground attack. They were stored in the back of, I don't remember the name of the carrier off the top of my head, the back of the ammo magazine on the carrier. They asked the ordnance chief. He's like, yeah, we've got some of those. Princeton. Yeah, we've got some of those back there. So they dug them out. They had a couple of the enlisted guys who, you know, remembered them from World War II. They checked them out, worked great. They came up with a plan. And the ADs went out and they did a torpedo run on the dam and busted it wide open. Just a great story of a problem. And folks in the squadron coming up with an idea of using an old weapon in a different way that got the job done. And it's just a great story, and that I think you can look at, regardless of what generation you served or continue to serve in, you'll recognize some of the personality types in that story. There's also some great pictures of it, and I think it's one of those stories that everybody should think about. All the challenges you can think of about fighting our China or helping defend our friends and allies from China. What are the weapon systems that perhaps are used for other things? Perhaps everybody thinks are obsolete and are tucked away in a magazine somewhere because nobody has sent out the message, tell everybody to take them off the ship. How can those be used in different ways and different target sets to be able to get the job done? That's what another thing I think is great about the story. It just demonstrates the fact that everything you train in workups may not be your solution, but plus it involves Sky Raiders, and everybody loves a Sky Raider story.
The SPAD. Yeah. Anyway, it's a great story, and I think the lesson, as you say, you know, you may have the most modern equipment in the world, but if you can't operate it under conditions of needing to turn off your radios and radar and all that good stuff, you have to start thinking creatively, and like these guys did with these Sky Raiders and those torpedoes. So, and, you know, Americans are noted for that kind of, used to be noted for that kind of ingenuity. I think we still have it, though.
We still have it. It's just waiting for a door to be open to step through. And there was a couple of snarky comments where one of the standard issue, I think he was a think tank guy, was making some commentary about the culture of the Chinese military. And everything he said could have been said about some of the problems we have in the U.S. military about the not encouraging creative thought. I was like, ooh, you know, be careful throwing that stone in a glass house. The walls are kind of thin there. But most people in the Navy have stories, some of your best sailors were also your greatest troublemakers. And that's a great part of our nation is we are a rebel nation, and we have some difficult people and difficult personalities. The whole key is finding a way to utilize that to our advantage, vice our detriment. But I think you're right. I think that part of the American character is there. It's just waiting for an opportunity to be asked to reveal itself, and it'll come up. It just needs the right environment.
Yeah. And on that, that's probably a good note to end today's show. And sorry, Paul, we didn't get to Admiral Stavridis' 2034, but I'm sure down the road we'll discuss that at some point if I ever find the time to read it.
And, well, as always, it's been a real fast hour. And next week is Mother's Day, so happy Mother's Day to everybody. And whether you are a mother or you have one of your immediate vicinity, so we'll have a best of next week, and then we'll catch everybody in a couple weeks.
Yep, it'll be fun. See y'all.
Okay. See you, everybody, and until next time, I hope y'all have a great Navy Day. Enjoyed it. Cheers.
Friend and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same.